Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C, this is Agriculture Today.
We do ask, and have been asking now, I think, going back to February, what do you expect the U.S. prime interest rate to be 1 year from now? And we picked up a bit of a change this month.
Dr. Jim Mentert is director for the Center for Commercial Agriculture, looking at the details of the July Ag Economy Barometer.
There were more people expecting an increase in interest rates over the course of the next year. In fact, the two buckets we give people are 0 to 1% higher and 1 to 2% higher if they're going to choose a higher rate. And you combine those two, 65% said that they expect to see rates go higher over the next 12 months. So roughly two-thirds of the people in the survey. That's up from about, I think, 57% that felt that way last month.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
I mean, I know that school starts in a couple weeks in many places. Either grade school kids and high school kids, you know, the K through 12 are going to be, you know, heading back. So things get a little slower around events, family events.
The calendar still says summer, but many events pointing to the end of that. Bob Mowers with Manduca Trading in Chicago.
But nonetheless, I think on the weekends and such, there's still opportunities for the demand to still be there. And then, you know, I know also all the college kids going back, and then I don't know, some that are already heading back now, as a matter of fact, just to kind of get a jump start on this academic year, but also in the bulk probably in the next couple few weeks. So similar story there. So things tend to slow down a little bit, but I don't think that we're really at a fact in a moment where it's really going to abate by much. And I think that things still look pretty solid for the cattle markets. If we look at it, though, to get into a bit of the more of the nitty-gritty there, I mean, the market looks solid. It's had its fluctuations. There's no doubt about it. When I say the market, I'm talking about the live cattle futures. We have seen a bit of a push down in the last week and a half or so, but it also coincided with some big rallies in the input market, the grains. And since a couple weeks ago, the markets have kind of, the grain markets have kind of fallen. And cattle markets are still sitting here in this little corrective zone. But I think that if the grain markets continue to move lower, I think that we're going to find some newfound buying. And then it's going to be a matter of kind of a wait and see. I mean, I'm not one to really call, tops or bottoms in the marketplace by any means. I kind of let the market tip its hand. And each time we've had a pretty considerable dip in prices for the live cattle futures, it's been met with some ultimate buying, which is pushed into new swing highs. So once that pattern fails, you know, if we try to get another push to the upside in it, and it fails, then that might be the signal that things are slowing down a little bit more than I expect. But at the moment, I think everything is just kind of going along with that pattern where rally, break, new highs, then break, then new highs, then break. And I don't see us breaking out of that pattern quite yet for a couple of reasons. Technically speaking, like I just mentioned, I think that's just the overall characteristic in the market right now. And then until something more material comes along, I think that technically speaking, those who look at the market, not so much in terms of the fundamentals, but just the price action, are going to be looking to buy the dips. And then also those who are, you know, fundamentally trading the market, things still look pretty good. In particular, I'm talking about weights. Average estimated dress cattle weight last week was 813 pounds. The five-year average for that week is 818. So weights are still a little bit on the lighter side in terms of the structure of the market right now. Packers are working with, you know, tighter margins than we've seen in quite a while, and they have reduced their slaughter speeds. But nonetheless, we'll see how that all plays out. I still think that they want to have enough throughput to keep things moving along. So it's really just a standoff at the moment, and I think that's one of the things that we've seen in the pricing over the last week and a half or so, a standoff between the Packers and the feedlots. So we'll see how that plays out, but I think things still look structurally strong. We're even at tighter margins. They're going to work to kind of keep things moving along, and at some point, you know, I think we'll probably pay up. We'll see how that goes. The slaughter to that point was a little bit weaker last week. Last week's slaughter was 619,000 head. That was 5,000 less than a week ago, 40,000 head less than a year ago. And, you know, that kind of shows a little bit at the moment that Packers have slowed things down a little bit.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
Normally, if you expect interest rates to go up, you would think that would create a somewhat unfavorable environment for investment.
Dr. Jim Mentert is director of the Center for Commercial Agriculture, looking at the most recent ag economy barometer.
But our survey isn't supporting that, at least so far. That was interesting to me.
Dr. Michael Langemeyer is an ag economist at Purdue.
Definitely very interesting. And the fact that a third of the people expect interest rates to increase 1% to 2%, that's on top of the 4% we've already seen in the last 18 months. That was a real kind of a surprising result. And that's a higher percentage increase than a lot of the industry analysts have been talking about. They've been talking about maybe the Fed will have some increases here, but it'd be below 1%.
Yeah, and as you and I were discussing again before the podcast, maybe that's more consistent with what's going on in the economy, because despite the increases in interest rates so far, the U.S. economy still seems to be somewhat surprisingly resilient.
And inflation has come down, but it's still pretty high. It's still quite a bit higher than that 2% target.
Yeah, so if the Fed really is serious about bringing down inflation, that 1% to 2% category might be...
It could be more reasonable.
If you and I were responding to the survey, that might be the category we would have chosen, huh? I think that's what we're kind of revealing here.
Mentored says it's all about interest rates.
If you think now is a bad time to make large investments in your farm operation, what's the primary reason for feeling that way? And if you look at the chart, and I want to remind our listeners, if you're interested, you can download these charts that Michael and I are reviewing. The chart shows a clear change in the pattern. The first time we asked this question, only 14% of the people in the survey chose rising interest rates as a problem. These last 3 months, for example, that's gone from 32% choosing rising interest rates in May to 35% choosing it in June, and now in July, 39% choosing it. And on the other side of the coin, what had been the number one factor for influencing people to say it's a bad time to make large investments, which was the increase in prices for farm machinery and new construction, has been falling. You know, when we first asked this question in July of 22, I think that was chosen by 44% of the people in the survey. In August of 22, it was chosen by 49%. That was the high in terms of picking that particular source of consternation. On the current survey, down to 29%. So significantly, I'd say, below the percentage choosing rising interest rates. So even though the Farm Capital Investment Index was up, it's clear that people are starting to think about interest rates, and at least some folks are saying that's an impediment to making large investments.
Another interesting aspect about this result is in 22, we know that there's some rather large increases in both farm machinery and new construction throughout the economy. This is not just farm machinery and new construction, throughout the U.S. economy and the world economy for that matter. The fact that 29% still say that increase in prices for farm machinery and new construction tells me that prices are still relatively high. They really haven't come down.
Yeah, that's a good point. We don't have data on retail transactions for farm equipment, but I noticed this week in the Wall Street Journal that when GM reported their results, they reported their average transaction price over the last 12 months. As supplies had increased, had actually gone up by, I think, $2,000 with their average transaction price, I think, now at $52,000. So we suspect that same thing, that same phenomenon is going on in farm machinery with respect to pricing, right? That they haven't really, there hasn't been enough of an increase in supplies to see those prices back off, and that's still showing up among people.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
Well, you can't have a farm bill without the resources. It's just a piece of paper.
Chairman of the House Budget Committee is Jody Arrington from Texas.
You know, you can map out the investment needed in the infrastructure for rural communities, and you can draw up just the right safety net to stabilize the ag economy and price risk and weather risk with crop insurance. You can have just the perfect farm bill, but if you don't have the resources, it doesn't work. And in fact, I don't think it's working now because of a lack of resources. We spend too much money. We're deep, deep in debt, $31 trillion. We have the highest debt load we've ever carried as a country, over 120% debt to GDP. The last time we had that level of indebtedness was just after World War II, but that was a world war. We were fighting in two parts of the world. Today, we have relative peace and relative prosperity, and things are just going to get worse when you look at the projections. We actually have a gap of $1.5 trillion in our budget and the funding of the people's government. And that $1.5 trillion, called the deficit, an annual deficit, will be $3 trillion in 10 years. The interest alone, just the interest on the debt, Tony, is over half a trillion today. It'll be $1.5 trillion annually in 10 years. And probably in 2 years, we'll spend more to service the debt than we spend on all of national defense, homeland security, and veterans. Now, that is a problem, and that is a debt crisis that looms over our country. So it's about prioritization, right? We're doing too many things. The federal government was never intended to do this much. We were supposed to focus on a few things and do them well. Food security would be one. But our debt is crowding out investment in defense. We're at decades low if you look at spending on the military per capita or per GDP. But the farm bill is another example. You know, if you can't feed your own people, you're not going to be a secure nation, and you're certainly not going to be the leader of the free world for very long. And so you've got to get the farm bill and our food supply infrastructure right. The safety net doesn't work today because of the input cost. It's because of inflation. We've had drought. We have supply chain problems that are post-COVID that are still not functioning the way they should. But the real issue is input costs have just run away from our producers. So their margin is thin to negative, and the safety net can't kick in even if prices were good, even if they're decent prices. The margin's horrible. So we've got to fix that, and that's going to require resources. That's where my position, being a West Texan and as the budget chair for the United States House of Representatives, I get to work with G.T. Thompson, our ag chairman, as I met with him a few days ago and said, hey, let's work on figuring out how we can save some money in the farm bill on reforms to food stamps, also known as supplemental nutrition, save some money on program integrity in farm programs, by the way. There's waste, fraud, and abuse in those. And let's quit doing this ad hoc disaster spending, which is about 80% of our spend over the last 5 years. We needed it, but Tony, we can't have unbudgeted ad hoc disaster spending. We need to have structural changes, structural enhancements, and the resources to make that safety net work, or we're going to have a lot of farmers out of business, and we're going to have less security and stability in the ag economy.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
The other interesting thing about this, we don't usually talk about this much either on the podcast or in the write-ups, but the percentage of people who expect their farms, financial performance to be better than or be about the same as last year is over 50% and has been for the last 2 months.
Dr. Jim Entert is director of the Center for Commercial Ag at Purdue.
53% this month, 54% last month. Before that, back in May, when things were looking maybe a little more dismal for some folks, 48%. That's been pretty consistent. That's kind of an interesting value as well, that over half the people expect things to be about the same.
He's reacting to the July results from the CME Group Purdue Ag Economy Barometer.
So another question we ask, do you think that a year from now, so looking ahead, a year from now, will your farm operation be better off financially, worse off, or about the same as now? And very small changes this month versus last month, but it kind of interesting to look at the change, I guess, over time. And so there was a 1 point increase in the farmers who expect farm financial conditions to improve in July. It went to 21% versus 20. The 1 point decline in the percentage of farmers expecting conditions to worsen. So 31% expected to worsen versus 32 last month. But the bigger story there to me is the fact that if you look at those numbers going back to this time last year, the percentage expecting a decline was in the ballpark of about 50%. And we're down to 31%. A year ago, the percentage expecting an improvement was in the low teens, and now we're up around 21%. I think that trend over time is kind of interesting.
And when looking even further down the road?
This is a different question, but it kind of points to that same idea that people are expecting 2024 to be pretty similar from an income standpoint and the impact financially on their farms as 2023. Okay. Then we ask a question about U.S. agriculture. And again, this is one we tend not to focus on very often, but it's one that we do ask consistently. Do you think it is more likely that U.S. agriculture during the next 5 years will have widespread good times or widespread bad times? And this index, or these responses to this question, tend not to be very variable. There's not a lot of movement from one month to the next. But it was kind of interesting that the percentage expecting bad times actually declined. And if you compare that percentage over time, it was down to 39% this month versus 41% last month. You know, over time, that's been as high as it's actually been above 50% a few times, but not very often.
Also says capital appears to be improving.
So the Farm Capital Investment Index improved this month. It came in at 45 versus 42 for an index value. You compare that to a year ago, that index was at 36, and then you go back 2 years ago, it was at 50. And again, the improvement this month is interesting, and it's consistent, I guess, with the modest improvement that we saw in the barometer, although maybe in some respects exceeds the improvement that we saw in the barometer. But the interesting thing to me of this one is, if you go back to the low point in 2022, that index got down to as low as 31. So it's climbed 14 points since, I think, the fall of 2022. That's a big move for this index. That's a much more positive value than what we were seeing as recently as last fall.
Looks like it's tied to strong liquidity.
Clearly, that's, I think, one of the factors driving this. And I think you're right about the pent-up demand. And the other thing is, even though interest rates are going up, I think people are maybe still not real concerned about that, although we've got some contrary evidence here in a second. But a lot of folks looking at making purchases out of working capital.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
You know, we have, especially in the area, you know, south of Lubbock, we really haven't gotten much rain since that, you know, round of weather that kind of brought us out of those drought conditions right around planting time at the first part of June.
Sean Wade is with Plains Cotton Growers, looking at very dry conditions across the southern high plains.
You know, those were very beneficial rainfall events. It certainly helped push us, you know, well down the road as far as getting this crop established and letting it, kind of hang on. But it's really becoming pretty dire, I think, for some of these dryland acres, especially those south of Lubbock that, you know, really haven't had much in the way of catching a stray shower here or there during the month of July. So. A lot of this dryland crop is pretty quickly running out of steam, and we're going to really be concerned about beginning to lose a fair number of those acres once we get to those bowl count appraisals in September, if this weather pattern really doesn't change drastically pretty quickly as well. Now on the irrigated side, so this is a little bit different story there. We've got some really good irrigated crops in some places. Some of it's, maybe about average, but we do have some good stands and do have a very good opportunity to make a pretty decent looking irrigated crop in a lot of areas here on the plains. Of course, the question is, how many acres do we have of irrigated? How many acres of dryland? What is the status of those acres? And that's something that we really, we're looking forward to August the 11th when we get that first USDA National Agricultural Statistics Service crop production estimate. That's going to kind of give us our first glimpse of what the USDA kind of forecasts for production in the state of Texas and nationally. But I think equally important is we're also going to be able to get access to the first information on certified acres from USDA Farm Service Agency as well on that day. And so that's really going to kind of be our first, concrete numbers as far as, what acres got planted, what's been failed to date, and in what areas. And then maybe give us some strong numbers that we can work forward to, from there to kind of I guess, you know, put that crystal ball to work and kind of see what this crop may look like as we get closer to the end of the season.
Many of those southern high plains dry land acres abandoned last year, but with those rains earlier, there was hope this year.
I think that is a very accurate concern that many of our dry land producers are looking at right now. You know, they did, you know, invest in this crop. A lot of them have, you know, put out some fertilizer. Certainly they're doing their normal due diligence, you know, to keep those fields clean of weeds and everything. But, you know, if we don't, you know, get some rain, you know, really pretty immediately, I think a lot of these crops are going to struggle to be able to, you know, kind of put on enough fruit, you know, later in the season if the rainfall kind of comes a little bit later. In order for them to, you know, to have it, I think, to kind of overcome some of those expenses that they've already incurred. So I think you're exactly right. There's a lot of concern that we may not, you know, be able to make enough yield to kind of really balance against those inputs that we put into it. And that's especially true on the dry land side.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
G.T. Thompson is the chair of the committee, and he's been going all around the country having listening sessions, and I've attended some of those.
Indiana Representative Dr. Jim Baird, a member of the House Ag Committee.
It's really interesting the things you learn about the different parts of our country, even though a lot of the problems you face, either water or temperature or time, are similar across different parts of the country. But then there are peculiarities that are also regional, in my opinion. And it's good to find those out. And it's good that we have the frontline information so we can make sure that the decisions we make about this 23 Farm Bill, and then there's, you know, the 2018 Farm Bill passed just before I got here. And it really did a lot of good things from the standpoint of conservation and all the various 12 titles that are in the Farm Bill. So now I think we just need to make sure we can tweak it appropriately to make sure all the industries are represented within agriculture and in the food supply chain.
Talks about conservation and specifically TSP, Technical Service Providers.
You know, the CRP, the Conservation Reserve Program, has worked very well to allow some of those acreages that maybe are less productive, gives an option and an alternative for using that land rather than enforcing production. And then when you take the accomplishments we've had in production and seed varieties, in fertility, the productivity off of the remaining acres, we continue to produce more and more crop and more yield every year. So then back to your question about the TSP, I'm not sure every state's involved in that, but it's one that it allows more flexibility and allows you to adapt to your own farm, and it can get involved in all the various aspects from forestry to conservation to water resource management and so on. So probably need a discussion about that and so on, which kind of leads me into one of the bills that Senator Braun in the Senate, and I have the matching bill in the House, the TSP bill, which is technology service providers. And the NRCS has suggested that they may need someplace in the neighborhood of 3,000 to 5,000 more individuals to provide services to farmers about all the aspects in the USDA programs, so that they can customize, so to speak, a program that fits that farm or fits the need they have in a particular area. And I think most people would say that trying to navigate the USDA and the NRCS programs and so on probably does take some additional help or some additional advice, and those technicians are available to do that. You know, if you're involved in production agriculture, you're really interested in getting the crop or the animals or whatever out and make sure that they're producing well. When you take all that time, you really don't have time to study some of the programs that are available that could be beneficial to have a TSP provider, technical service provider, go through that and look at whatever your situation is on your farm or ranch, and then design a program, customize a program that accomplishes that. And so there's more flexibility in the TSP program, but the CRP program has been around and very successful.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
The process of crafting a new farm bill is into its final key phase now. What's been the USDA's role in this process?
Having served as a U.S. representative, I know that it's Congress that writes the farm bill.
Not the USDA. Deputy Agriculture Secretary Sotiril Torres-Small told us that a few administrations in the past have written their own versions of farm bills and pushed those to lawmakers. She says that's not the approach of this administration instead.
USDA stands ready and is very much engaged in providing technical assistance and making sure that we serve as a voice for farmers and ranchers and rural people and people who depend on SNAP and our mini nutrition programs, that when we get asked, what do you think about this program or this change, that we're reflecting the many customers that we serve.
But again, she says USDA's role is to assist lawmakers as they write the new farm bill. The current bill expires in less than 2 months. Gary Crawford, Washington.